Next case is State versus Knight. Council may approach. Good afternoon. This is State versus Knight.
Good afternoon. I would like to reserve 2 minutes, please. May it please the court, my name is Katie Reichertz from the law firm of Chalupka, Holyoke, Snyder, Chalupka, Longoria, and Scotts Bluff. I represent the appellant and defendant in this case, Justin Knight. Mr. Knight appeals a couple of different issues from the Scotts Bluff County District Court, where he was convicted of possession of methamphetamine with intent to distribute, possession of a defaced firearm, and possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. There are several assignments of error in this case, first being that the court erred by overruling Mr. Knight's motion to suppress, the second, that there was insufficient evidence to support the convictions, and third, that Mr. Knight's trial counsel was ineffective in a number of ways. I would like to note for the court's information that I am actually the fourth attorney to represent Mr. Knight in these proceedings, and I think that's probably something that went into the all the errors that are asserted regarding ineffective assistance of counsel.
Counsel, can you start off with, on what basis did your client have standing to contest or try to suppress the search and seizure of the other two gentlemen?
In that particular situation, Your Honor, I believe he had standing to contest that search because part of the search was directed toward the property that was allegedly his in that vehicle. And then the state turned around to try to use those goods in the trial against Mr. Knight. I think it's kind of interesting in this situation because a lot of the information about why Mr. Knight was implicated in this is because he was the driver of this vehicle based on the information from the passengers. And so therefore, all the items that were found as a result of the search should be used against him. On the other hand, he lacked standing to contest the search because he didn't own the particular vehicle and he wasn't sitting in it at the time that the search went down. So it seems like the state in this situation is trying to have its cake and eat it too, in that there's no standing, you can't contest the search, but I'm going to use all this stuff in the search against you.
But isn't there already law that says that a defendant in a criminal case doesn't have standing to assert a Fourth Amendment claim just because there was evidence obtained as a result of what may have been an invalid search of third parties?
Yes, I believe that's what Van Akron stands for, Judge. And I think that Van Akron also states that a person against whom a search is directed and property seized has standing to challenge the validity of the search where the state's case against him depends on his possession of the goods. So I think that the case could also be used to assert that Mr. Knight did have standing to contest that search. What I think is interesting and goes to one of the assignments of error regarding ineffective assistance of counsel is that trial counsel never did request a suppression hearing for Mr. Knight's seizure.
He requested it. I mean, he made a motion regarding that, right? But they just never got to a hearing on it.
Correct. So the first two attorneys in this case did both file motions to suppress the seizure of Mr. Knight. But when we get to the suppression hearing, the trial counsel at that point says, we're not going to have a hearing on that today. All we're going to assert today is the search of the vehicle and the seizure of the occupants of the vehicle. So we never have a hearing on whether Mr. Knight's seizure was valid. And I think that is ended up being very prejudicial to Mr. Knight because in this situation, I think that Mr. Knight's seizure, there lacked reasonable suspicion to do that. And unfortunately, the record, we have no information about what happened when law enforcement went into Lucky Kino, made contact with Mr. Knight, and then brought him out. We don't have any information because that was never, there were never questions asked about that at the suppression hearing or at trial. So we just don't have information about that. But I think that what's clear through the record is that the state lacked reasonable suspicion at that time to go in and get Mr. Knight, seize him, and bring him out, where the officer says, you're not under arrest, but you are detained. And at that point, it, of course, is a Tier 2 encounter. And I think that when you look at the exhibit number 2, which is that surveillance video from Western Trails Terminal, Western Travel Terminal, and Debbie Dodge's testimony, it's pretty clear that he lacked reasonable suspicion at that point to detain Mr. Knight in that way. when you look at that video, none of the officers are really paying attention to these two people that are coming in and out. And what's interesting is that Deputy Dodge rests his hat on, he saw Mr. Kubik, the co-defendant in this case, reach into his pocket and pull out a big stack of bills, $100 bills, and start counting that in a convenience mart. From Deputy Dodge's standpoint, I don't think that he could have seen that when you look at the video, the surveillance video. But secondly, someone pulling out a wad of money in a convenience mart is not all that unusual. So he sees that information and he goes back and he checks the bathroom. There's no evidence of any drugs or anything like that. So they leave. And then about 15 minutes later or so, he gets a call saying, this vehicle is at Rolkikino, come on over and check it out. So at that point, all he has is this information that he saw this guy walking, pulling out a wad of cash in a convenience mart, and then this vehicle parked at Rolkikino, which the officer says, you know, it's known for drug trafficking and whatnot. So those were the two things he was saying gave him reasonable suspicion. But I don't think those are sufficient to then detain Mr. Knight in the fashion that was done. You know, he'd go up to the vehicle and say, well, our uncle or a friend is in Rolkikino. His name is Justin. I mean, at that time, the officers don't even know what Justin looks like. He wasn't in one of the ones on the video. He obviously was not in the vehicle. And so, unfortunately, the record's just void of any information about what happened inside Rolkikino. And so I think that the assignment of error number 7 in this case is it's pretty evident that there was an effective assistance of counsel when trial counsel did not have a suppression hearing on this matter and flesh this out. And I think it's certainly prejudicial to Mr. Knight, because if we'd had that suppression hearing, we may not be here today. So the other, I guess, issues regarding ineffective assistance of counsel that I think are important to bring to the court's attention today is number 5, in that trial counsel did not file a motion in limine, a 403 motion, or ask for a limiting instruction regarding Deputy Holcomb's interview of Mr. Knight. And in that interview, Deputy Holcomb, makes some statements about whether or not he believes Mr. Knight. He says, I think you're minimizing. I think you're not telling me the whole truth. And I think that those questions go over the Rocha line. And it was an effective for trial counsel not to at least ask for a limiting instruction. The state does, in its brief, cites to a couple of cases which I think are distinguishable to this issue, specifically State v. Hang, which I think is probably more akin to this case factually. But in that situation, there was a limiting instruction at trial where the district court told the jury, you can't take what the officer says or any other purpose other than context in the situation. We didn't have that in this case. And so the jury heard what the officer said about you're minimizing your involvement, you're not telling me the truth. And so those statements, I think, then went to whether there was sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Knight in this case, because he only admitted to possessing, I believe it was about 49 grams of methamphetamine. So he's saying, I wasn't a part of what Mr. Kubik had going on. I don't know how much meth he had on him. But the officer saying, I don't believe you. That's played in front of the jury. That's prejudicial.
But what wasn't there enough from the other witnesses to question Mr. Knight's minimization and his actual involvement in all?
If we're talking about Isaiah Artigson, he stated in his testimony that the baggie that was found on Mr. Kubik was always with Mr. Kubik. The first time that Mr. Artigson saw it, it was on Mr. Kubik's person. He may have seen it in the hotel. He never said that Mr. Knight had possession of the baggie. And then Ms. Yeckel's testimony was essentially, yeah, I helped Mr. Knight go to these different houses and sell. She didn't testify to any kind of amount.
Wasn't there evidence of a wire transfer that was initiated by Mr. Knight?
There was. I think that the state was trying to get some evidence about that, and I think the state's brief in this situation kind of nails it on the head where it says presumptively he was trying to wire some money. I don't think that the evidence was sufficient to show that that was necessarily what was going on. Furthermore, I think that trial counsel failed to object to some of that evidence that had on the basis of hearsay, because there was receipts, there were driver's license, things like that had names. different types of conversation that I think was inadmissible hearsay, and again, trial counsel failed to object, therefore that was ineffective and prejudicial. So I don't have much time, so I'll reserve the 20 seconds that I have left. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Ralph.
Good afternoon. Just going to grab some water.
We always put a trick lid
on.
Yeah. May it please the court. My name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. Three real issues here. One, the motion to suppress, overarching issues, I should say. The motion to suppress, the sufficiency of the evidence, and then the ineffective claims. As I said in my brief, and as I'll explain here in detail shortly, we think the district court's overruling of the motion to suppress was correct because the defendant lacked standing and challenged the seizure of Kubik and Ortgeson. The sufficiency, I think, based on the record standard of review, also was sufficient to support the convictions, and the ineffective claims were either insufficiently alleged or without merit.
Can you address the ineffective assistance claim with respect to not pursuing the motion to suppress on the arrest or search and seizure of Mr.
Sure.
Knight?
So at the point that the defendant, basically my position is that there's no ineffective assistance because such a motion would have been without merit. At the point that he is arrested, we have the footage from the WTT, we have the seizure and search of the individuals Kubik and Ortgeson, Kubik found with 186 grams of meth, and we have them identifying Mr. Knight as the driver. So clearly reasonable suspicion, probable cause to arrest, in our opinion, and so them going into the club to find Mr. Knight, however they did that, and then bringing him back outside and everything that occurred after that was proper. There was justification under the Fourth Amendment for doing so. As far as the Fourth Amendment claim regarding the motion to suppress, I think it's key to emphasize what was argued in the brief. The defendant argued in the brief that the seizure of Kubik and Ortgeson was improper, did not mention the search of the vehicle outside of a brief sentence in the summary of the argument section. So it was focused on the seizure of these two individuals. And as I pointed out in my brief, obviously a defendant does not have a Fourth Amendment interest in arguing the seizure of other people is improper. So there can be no error in the overruling of the motion to suppress on that ground. Sufficiency of the evidence, I don't really see too much there. I pointed out in my brief that the reliance on the version of accused's rule has been disavowed by the Nebraska Supreme Court repeatedly, and that based on the review of the elements of each of the statutory sections as well as the record, there's certainly enough evidence from which a rational trier of fact could have found the defendant guilty. For example, in the possession of the methamphetamine, you have him admitting to selling methamphetamine, the wire transfer of $1,300, to Kubik that he, initiated. You had the him driving the truck, him being the one that bought and paid for the hotel room, as well as him saying that he participated in these transactions the days prior. So clearly enough evidence for a rational trier of fact to find him guilty of jointly possessing the methamphetamine with Kubik.
What about the ineffective assistance of counsel claim related to the deputy's statements in Exhibit 22, the interview?
Right. So as I pointed out in my brief, I think really there were five groups of statements that the defendant focused on as being allegedly in violation of ROCA. The first and last, we did not think, we submit that ROCA is inapplicable, that they weren't really statements of credibility. It was more, the first statement was sort of like, hey, this is why we're here, this is the situation, I need you to talk to me. The last challenge statements was basically him saying, hey, if you want to actually be a confidential informant, here's what we're going to need. We're going to need substantial information, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't really focused on the credibility. As far as the three intermediate groups of statements, I think my citation to Hang was really to emphasize that we're not in a situation where it's simply a narrative discussion or a narrative statement by the detective, which is what Hang actually found appropriate, only the one statement at the end. We're in a back-and-forth exchange, a conversation-type interview. And so, to me, that context is critical, and that's what the Nebraska Supreme Court, I think, think, emphasized in Houston, which is how can we really, you know, give value or understand the defendant's statements if the conversation partner isn't there? And the defendant's statements here were critical because he's alleging basically, hey, I didn't really have the big baggie. I did, you know, a couple minor transactions. It's really all Cubic. It's really all Misty Yekyll. And so his credibility and what those statements, how we evaluate those statements is key. And to understand those statements, I think you need the detective's questions and comments in that back and forth exchange. So I don't think that Rocha really comes into play here. This isn't the type of error that Rocha is meant to address. I did have a harmless error pitch as well in the brief, just in case you disagree, but really resting on Rocha's inapplicability to that section or that portion of the interviews. As far as the remaining ineffective claims, unless this court has questions, I would submit those on the brief. Thank you. We ask you to affirm the judgment.
Thank you.
What is our official amount of time left for rebuttal?
15 seconds.
You want 15 seconds?
In discussing what Deputy Holcomb said, I think the Exhibit 22, what he was saying about Mr. Knight goes straight to Mr. Knight's credibility, which is exactly what Rocha is intended to prevent. He's talking about, I don't believe you, I think you're minimizing. That goes straight to credibility, and there should have been at least, at a bare minimum, a request for a limiting instruction.
Thank you. Thank you both. We will take the case under advisement. We appreciate you being here.